Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, October 21st. A rally at Iolani Palace grounds is taking place in response to a lawsuit challenging the admission practices of Kamehameha schools. We hear firsthand about the challenges of transitioning from fossil fuels to sustainable energy from island countries across the globe. What can Hawaii do to help? We learn about building back, how a storm hit one school on a tiny island, and it's been waiting for 7 years for a permanent campus. And we tip our hats to our native snails and learn about the creation of something called a frozen zoo. The Hawaii International Film Festival is in full swing this week. We hail a film about a native bird's lawsuit against the government. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour, a rally at Iolani Palace has just wrapped up. It started at 10 this morning and was organized by Kamehameha Schools. It's in response to a lawsuit filed yesterday by a mainland group, Students for Fair Admissions, which was challenging the school's admission policy, giving preference to Native Hawaiian students. KS Board Chair Crystal Rose was on the lineup to address the crowd. We talked to Jacob Aki, who is president of the Oahu Council of the Association of Native Hawaiian Civic Clubs, who was on the palace grounds for the event.
Obviously, this is a very passionate issue that affects more than just graduates. It's really a Hawaiian community issue. So it's really an opportunity, I think, for the school to really rally the broader community and really the broader state to help folks realize and to educate them about how important the princess's will is, you know, and why it's so important at this time that people come together to really do everything we can to defend the trust.
Well, you know, KS has seen challenges in the past about its admission. Yeah. And also, I believe there was a teacher that had filed a suit because of the hiring practices. I think you had to be Protestant in order to apply. How have those experiences helped KS weather this storm?
I think, you know, what we've seen is a change in the legal and the political landscape. Obviously, when we look at the federal level, we have a conservative Supreme Court, we have a conservative Congress, we have a conservative administration, and we have legal cases that have struck down things like affirmative action for Harvard, the University of North Carolina, and we're seeing SFFA and Edward Bloom successfully win these legal court cases, which is a lot different than when the last time the school went through this almost 20 years ago. So the legal landscape has changed. I think what we're going to see is a lot of different arguments be used. One in particular that's really important is recognizing that Native Hawaiians are a recognized political class. We are federally recognized in over 100 federal statutes. So our standing is more than just a ethnic group, but we are a protected political class. And I think that goes a long way in this court case. I think what we're also going to see different is really, you know, looking at the lens in which Pauahi wrote the will. She wrote the will in 1883, 10 years before the illegal overthrow. So the lens in which she wrote her will, you know, the governance and the legal landscape in which she executed her will was still during the Hawaiian Kingdom. And we've seen, you know, many court cases actually defer to kingdom law in many cases. So I think, you know, the school is really going to have to be creative, but I think there's a solid legal standing to really protect this case. It went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Court, and the Ninth Circuit Court about 15 years ago ruled in favor of the school. So I think there's a strong legal standing. You know, with a change in the politics and a change in the legal landscape, there is a lot to worry about, though.
KS did settle one of those lawsuits, and so it's not clear, it's not clean, and in a way it's just left itself open to this challenge.
And for many of us who have been following this issue closely, I was a student at the schools when we were going through this the last time. It was always a matter of this question of when the next lawsuit was going to come. It was never a matter of if, but really a matter of when. So the school has been preparing for this for a very long time. The community, many of those who are civically engaged, have been waiting for this. So I think you're, you know, what's going to maybe be a lot different is you're going to see a lot more engagement from the broader community with tools like social media. I think more and more people are going to get educated, and there's going to be a lot of political pressure. There's going to be a lot of pressure coming from the community. Hopefully that plays into how things play out, you know, this time around.
We've been hearing from Jacob Aki from the Council of Association of Native Hawaiian Civic Clubs, who was taking part in a rally at Iolani Palace this morning. It was a show of community support for Kamehameha Schools as it defends its admissions practice of giving Native Hawaiian students preference. The mainland group, Students for Fair Admissions, filed a lawsuit on Monday asking the federal district court to strike down the race-based admissions policy. The Blue Planet Alliance has brought together some 40 island countries for the last 5 years to find solutions to their energy challenges. This week kicked off a gathering of community leaders from those island nations to share what has worked and what hasn't in achieving their energy goals. Here's Blue Planet's Jeff Mikulina.
So it's bringing together island leaders from around the world to learn from and to share with Hawaii on our transition to 100% renewable energy. So all of these islands around the world are dealing with the very same issues we are here, both technology issues, regulatory, financing, climate change. And so the more we can learn from each other, the stronger we'll all be.
And then you have them doing a Lego exercise. What's all that about?
So today's the kickoff day. So it's a lot of learning from each other, but learning for them to embrace complexity and understand the systems on their islands, the systems, how things really work. So not just the technology and, say, the power grid, but actually how things get done or don't get done on the islands. And so we have them playing with Lego because it gets you out of your head and gets you into your hands a little bit. And, you know, you kind of produce these metaphorical models about this is how we can move things forward. These are the barriers. Here are the challenges we have to solve for. So it's just a really great exercise to look into the islands and understand the systems better.
Yeah, so I guess if they can recognize what's in the way of achieving the goal, that they can chip away at it.
Exactly. And we have these narratives, these mental models. But once you start playing with Legos and building them out, and then more importantly, working with your fellow islanders on it, it really reveals something new. And that's what we hope to accomplish with this. And there's nothing more fun than seeing a bunch of professionals and adults and legislators playing with Lego.
And talk about the countries that are here.
So we have 8 island groups that are joining us. This particular cohort, there are many from the Caribbean. So we've had a lot from the Pacific before. About 40 different islands have come through. But now we have Anguilla, Costa Rica, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Marshall Islands, Mauritius, Panama, and St. Martin.
So there may be some situations that we here in the Pacific are familiar with, but across the other way, across the globe, they may have particular challenges.
Very interesting. I think something that's been reinforced here is you have some of these small islands that are looking at doing solar, similar to what we've done. What's going to be fun this week is on Wednesday, they're going to go up to Mililani Solar and look at that agrivoltaic, or the solar and the farming combined, and hopefully take some lessons from that they can bring home. But one of the acute challenges that Caribbean islands face that is also happens in the Pacific, but it's very acute in the Caribbean, is hurricanes. And so a lot of these are looking, what systems can we build that have the resilience to be able to withstand Category 5 hurricanes, which aren't every 30 years, but they're almost biannual thing. So how can they really build resilient energy systems that are also renewable?
Yeah, because here in Hawaii, we've been very fortunate that we've been spared. We haven't had a really big one in a long time. But yeah, it's just something to be mindful of. What works here may not work somewhere else. And then their geographic location may be, they may be in a typhoon alley or something else that makes it a little bit more unique and challenging.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the takeaways here is one size does not fit all. So it's finding place-based resources that work. On some islands, it might be wind. Other places, it might be a great solar resource. Or Costa Rica, a lot of hydroelectric or geothermal. So it's finding those resources that are going to work best for that island, that the community accepts, that are going to be lowest cost and most secure into the future.
I know this administration is not too green energy, clean energy friendly. We're dealing with just a complete reversal of fortunes here. But yeah, how do you, I guess, communicate that to the folks that are here at this conference?
Yeah, I think, you know, folks come to Hawaii, and I think sometimes you have to remind them that this is part of the United States, even though we feel so removed. We're also really taking a long view on this. Isn't, you know, the next couple of years, this is the next 5, 10, 20 years for these islands. And I think there's a couple of overwhelming messages, and one is technology and economics are on renewable side. Every year, technology is improving. We can enjoy these learning curves. Technologies beat commodities day in and day out. So, you know, that momentum is on our side. Similarly, as they get lower cost, whatever federal credits and incentives were there, we're just getting those back because the technology is getting cheaper. Batteries that Kauai invested in 5 or 10 years ago are expensive compared to today's unsubsidized batteries. We're confident that there's technology momentum on our side and really taking the long view as these islands look at their plans. This is the fifth cohort of groups that we brought through here. We do it at East-West Center. It's a week-long deep dive in all the dimensions of this renewable transition, technology, financing, regulatory, policy. And every time it's an eye-opener, just seeing that these islands face the exact same challenges. Many are at different stages. Some are exactly where Hawaii was 15 years ago. And it's a lot of fun just hearing the challenges that they're hitting and saying, oh, we had that exact same challenge, and here's what we learned. Your mileage may vary. But then also sharing some of the lessons learned here, some things that really didn't work. So maybe let's take a different approach. On Thursday, we have Gwen Yamamoto Lau from Hawaii's Green Bank. She's always a favorite because it's such a good success story in Hawaii, how we've been able to provide low-interest solar for largely low to moderate-income families. And that's a model that can easily be replicated across islands and across the continent.
That was Jeff Michelina of the Blue Planet Alliance, who we talked to yesterday. He was talking about bringing together island countries across the globe to talk about energy resilience. As for those Lego masterpieces, well, we heard a cross-section of challenges, including the political climate in Haiti. Here's Haitian economist Etzer Emile explaining his Lego model, which showed two halves, one in black and one in color.
We have like a large population in Haiti who doesn't have access to energy, like over 70%. That's very critical. But in the next phase, we have some bright color. That means it's interesting and important for us to design new policy and bring new investment for us to move from the left side to the right side and to change the color of the perspective. But you need this ecosystem with the government first that should lead the way in terms of policy and also institution and organization to find the right environment to invest. But we still have a lack of good policy in the country. It's important for us as a team from this experience here in the Blue Planet Initiative to learn and to get inspired from countries like Costa Rica, for example. I was impressed. I know they're very successful, but I didn't know if they were so close to 100% of renewable energy in the power mix. We have a large population. Haiti has the largest population in the Caribbean, over 12 million people. And then more than 7 million don't have access to electricity. So the need is big, so we have to make sure that we produce enough energy to be able to serve the community, the business, the people, schools, hospitals, and everything here, and to make sure we can create a better life for them and also the path for prosperity.
And it's Ground Zero in St. Martin that has yet to take that first step. Here's Aridi Samtani using her Lego creation to explain how far her country needs to go to fix a fragmented system.
St. Martin relies 100% on fossil fuels. We are at stage zero of our energy transition. And here we can clearly see that the first step in our energy transition is connecting all of those different bodies together through a bridge and through different pathways and steps. We also have here representing a hurricane because we've experienced a lot of barriers to progress due to recovery from a natural disaster. Hurricane Irma devastated 95% of our infrastructure. So recovery was a huge first step in being able to even consider what next steps we need to take.
We have been hearing from some of the participants in the Blue Planet Alliance Fellowship Program that is taking place at the East-West Center. It runs through the end of the week.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra's Films in Concert series, presenting Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince in concert October 25th and 26th. The full film and score at the Blaisdell Concert Hall.
I'm Marco Werman. Each day on The World, we step outside our borders to hear what's going on around the planet and to hear how events in the United States are seen across Africa, Europe, Asia, and the Americas. Our producers and reporters dig deep to find stories that connect you with what's happening worldwide. That's why we call it The World. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 1, here on HPR 1.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
This morning, Honolulu Civil Beat has a lead story highlighting the difficulties of building back from a Category 5 storm. Reporter Marcel Henri joins us now. Good morning, Marcel.
Morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, you know, we just heard about St. Martin's and its challenges with building back after a big hurricane. And over where you went in Saipan, they call them typhoons.
Right. Hurricanes being the same as typhoons. And the story that we have up, our lead story today, it's part of a broader series we've been doing that basically looks to highlight how climate change is already impacting communities across the Pacific and to tell those stories as best we can through the eyes and the perspective of those community members. So this is pertaining to a super typhoon that hit Saipan back in 2018. And, you know, of course, that's part of the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. It's just north of Guam, and it's no stranger to these very severe and strong storms. But it did get pummeled especially hard. This was the strongest storm to hit any part of the U.S. territory in 80 years, sustained winds of 100 miles an hour and gusts that were double that. And you know, it really it just caused widespread devastation across Saipan, and it was the second storm to hit of similar magnitude within a 3-year period. And this story really hones in on the largest middle school on Saipan, which has still yet to be rebuilt in 2025. And I talked to various former students of Hopwood that were attending that school before YouTube, and then just immediately after YouTube. And it was quite an experience to try and continue their curriculum and their education under some pretty challenging circumstances and environments, to say the least. And it's a situation which they made some progress, but you know, it's 2025 and that school is still yet to be rebuilt.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary when you think 7 years, and then, you know, we worry too about Lahaina, right? All the schools that got burned in that wildfire, and you hope that the recovery is not going to take that long.
Right. This is kind of a bit of a cautionary tale. I mean, we've seen our rain bombs and our wildfires, and, you know, certainly communities on Hawaii that are, you know, right, Lahaina, you know, is going to take a very long time. But this story also looks into FEMA's efforts and some of the issues with FEMA, some of the issues on the local side too. You know, it's not a simple silver bullet to say this is what was wrong. There is a, you know, there's a multitude of factors on both the federal and the local level there on Saipan that have kind of gotten us to where we are. And this story at least tries to kind of pick apart some of what was going on there. And it also talks about, you know, how we're seeing more and more natural disasters that FEMA has had to respond to as climate change has intensified. And we're also in a moment where, you know, the current Trump administration is looking to basically phase out FEMA as much as it can and put a lot of the impetus on states and local governments to respond to these natural disasters.
Yeah, and it's tough for these tiny governments, right? There's not a very large economic base. And so, if FEMA pulls out, what then?
Yeah, in fact, that's kind of what happened here is that right after this super typhoon, the CNMI government faced a really steep and severe budget cut, and they weren't able to put in the matching dollars that they needed to kind of get things going. It makes it that much harder, frankly, from the folks that I talk to if you're not going to have that federal support.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Marcel, for highlighting this.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking to reporter Marcel Henry, who put the spotlight on the long road to recovery of a school following a typhoon on the tiny island of Saipan. You can read his story at civilbeat.org. Lots of big news this fall for our native snails, Arkahuli. So we're going to geek out on mollusks this morning. Bishop Museum announced last month that crews out in the field discovered two species of snails on Kauai that were thought to be extinct. Those snails, which have not been seen in about 100 years, are reproducing at the snail rearing facility here on Oahu. We got a sneak preview recently. Here's malacologist Noreen Young of the Bishop Museum describing those tiny snails.
So that's Godwinia, right? Dosu, they're together right now. They're sunbathing themselves on the leaf. That Dosu.
And so that's one particular species?
Yeah, so that's Godwinia caparata. The last time that was seen was about 94 years ago. So we have a database that have records from six of the U.S. Natural History Museums with the largest malacology Pacific Island land snail holdings. And so with this database, we are able to query everybody's database to see when was the last time these were ever collected, recorded alive and such. And so the last recording was 94 years ago. And then we have Hiona exequata somewhere. Hiona exequata was last recorded in 1926. And so, yeah, nearly 100 years for both of these snails that have not been in any actual published records or records of the museum. Yes.
And so you actually went to Kauai and gathered these.
Yeah, it was actually two conservation managers that we were able to help train and that we gave taxonomic workshops to say, these are the ones that we want to be looking for. So if you are ever out there and you see something that looks similar, please take a picture and let me know. And so they did. And so we were actually able to go there earlier this month to verify that they are what they were from the images. So we were so excited that we had a healthy population, that they were quite numerous comparatively to, you know, what the historical records used to say. But we were confident enough that it was healthy enough that we were able to bring some individuals back to study to make sure that we know what habitat, what they need to eat before they reproduce, all of those things. Because we want to make sure that we know how to take care of them now and not have to worry about when there is only four or five left and be so stressed of what do you need to survive, right? So this is allowing us a chance to figure out, just in case if something does happen, we can take them from the field, safeguard them until we can figure out a way to put them back into the forest where they can continue to thrive.
Okay, and so far, so good.
So far, so good. And we have a couple of keikis.
Also big in the news is that Hawaii will soon become a resource center for what's called a frozen zoo. where scientists will expand something called biobanking, freezing snail cell lines and lines of other native species. We got a chance to go out in the field recently in the Waianae Mountain Range, where we got to experience a day in the life of conservation scientists. Ecology and conservation go hand in hand. Natural habitat is the key. Without native plants and trees, so go the snails. Unlike snails from the mainland, Hawaii snails don't eat plants. They eat algae and bacteria on the plants. And it's not all plants. They do have favorites. Here's scientist Ken Hayes.
Anytime we find plants that have lots of snails relative to just random chance, we try to swab them and look at their microbiome. We've now done it for about 3,000 or so different plants, getting close to 100 species or more. I think the last count was like 120 species of plants at 13 different sites, two different islands. And what's amazing about that is the patterns are largely consistent. So it's the same lineages of plants. They may not always be the exact same species, but usually the same genus. But like Conival is really common in most wet forest on the islands. And so we see it here, we see it PKW, see it on Kauai, we see it on Big Island. And it's consistently one of the most preferred plants when it's available. So something about it snails really like.
So it's location, location, location.
Yeah, exactly. And so we're trying to figure out what drives that for two reasons. One is that, well, we want to better rear them in captivity so we can have more babies and get more back out in the wild. But the other reason is so that we can restore habitats. And we really now think there's a link between snails, plants, and the health of the ecosystem.
Back in the museum, Ken and Nori talk about their passion and the upcoming Kahului Festival. The theme this year, the land snails sing.
So we've got the snails in the wild, checking on them, what kind of plants they're on, the microbial communities that they need, trying to understand that, and then protecting them while we try to figure that out in these exclosures. So the exclosures are like our intermediaries. So we bring snails in from the wild back to the SEPS captive rearing program, and we try to raise them up and understand their life history. So what do they need to produce lots of babies, and how long does that take gathering all that information so that we can then put them back out into these exclosures that are in the wild that protects them from predators, but gives them a more natural or closer to natural setting with the native plants. And all that goes together just as they're, I don't want to say just stopgap, but they're a temporary solution until we can figure out how to restore some of these natural ecosystems.
And then I've heard them referred to as snail jails or was it condo?
Yeah, conchological condos or mollusk mansions, right? Yeah.
How many do we have across the state?
I think there are 9 on Oahu, 2 on Maui, and 2 on Lanai for sure. And I think that's it. I think there's 13 or 14 total. So most of them are on Oahu right now. There's one planned for the Big Island up above Waimea, up above in Parker Ranch area. And there's one being planned for Molokai as well, up near Pu'ali'i or Olokui, one of the two. I don't know exactly where they're going to put it yet. But
okay, but the idea is you can protect them from predators and hopefully fires, or at least you know where they're staying. Right. You know their address.
Yeah, the idea is to have these various approaches, tools, if you will, to try to conserve them for as long as possible. And it's necessary to do this in different ways in different regions because the snails are all endemic to different parts of islands and different islands. From where we just came from on Kauai, rediscovering 2 species of snails that are endemic to Kauai that hadn't been seen in almost 100 years. And they were in very surprising habitats, sort of pretty dry, living on the ground under rotting ohia logs and things like that, and only really emerging at night when it's cooler and wetter. And we couldn't even find them hardly during the day. But then they came out at night, and so we've got a few of those, and they've already producing babies here in captivity. So we're super excited about that. And so the idea there is to rear up as many as we can, figure out what they need to survive, and then return some of them to the wild, help augment those populations. But if we have to, put them in various exclosures in the field to protect them while we can.
And then, Nori, jump in here. Is there anything you want to add just about the discovery of these snails?
We always say, don't lose hope, right? There are so many areas that we still need to be searching. There's little pockets in all of the islands and all of the forests that we have a chance to rediscover them, that we haven't lost hope that they're gone. In many places, people have said that, you know, our land snails no longer sing. And in many times we just don't know where to be looking or what to be looking for, right? So that's why these collections are so important to allow us to visualize what we need to be searching for. And as we are doing a lot more education outreach and talking to conservation managers that are boots on the ground, they're working so hard in the field, day in and day out, they would be the ones to be the first people to be like, oh, I think I found something. And so I get really excited when I get these calls, these photographs from these conservation managers that are like, oh, I found something, Nori. And I'm like, oh, what is it? And then a lot of times it has turned out to be really exciting news. So I'm really always hopeful that we can continue to add more species back to the list that are not extinct.
And I understand you folks just came back from a trip. I don't know if what you can share about a frozen zoo and hope for snails. I don't know.
Yeah, so in an effort, again, in the arsenal of conservation tools, there's a lot of them. And one of the sort of most profound, I think, it's pretty inspiring to me, is the San Diego Zoo in 1975 started what they called the frozen zoo. They recognized that they were housing many of these incredibly rare endangered species from all over the world, like Sumatran rhinos and tigers, and just incredible animals. They were icons of conservation now, many of them being lost. And the founder of this, he had the vision to say, what can we do to conserve these? And he was actually a medical doctor, though. He was a placentologist, right? So he studied placenta at the medical school. And he was fascinated with twins, right? What caused twins. But he had this idea that you could take germ cell lines, the cell lines that produce all the other cells and stem cells, and freeze those down and keep them living frozen tissues that you could then one day reconstitute these species, putting back into embryos and surrogates. And technology that we knew was possible, we were only beginning to dream of then. But now 50 years later, to sit in that symposium, and that's what I was invited there to be a panelist, because now they're partnering with the IUCN, which is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and other groups like Colossal Biosciences and Revive and Restore. And these agencies are getting together and they're trying to expand, as part of their 50th anniversary campaign, is to expand their biobanking capacity. So these facilities that have the capability of doing that in biodiversity hotspots. So they're going to build one in Peru, one in Kenya, one in Vietnam, and we will be the Pacific hub for Hawaii. So the Bishop Museum's partnering with them, and we're going to build out our current cryo facility, which, you know, houses about 95,000 tissue samples from various plants and animals across Hawaii, and expand that into more tissue samples, but also into cell lines for living cultures, if you will, so that we can safeguard, add another tool to that. And so it's a really exciting opportunity because they have the best experience and expertise in the world to do this. And this partnership is going to allow for our people here to get trained and build that capacity locally.
So we'll have a frozen zoo of snails.
Snails, but also birds and plants and insects and microbes. And so really trying to biobank diversity, right? Biobank biodiversity as we can understand it. Because really, I mean, if we just save the snails, we probably won't have much left. And we just save the trees, we won't have, but we need the trees, we need the microbes, we need the snails, the insects, and the birds. And we're going to leverage that technology that they've developed doing Sumatran rhinos and honey creepers and other things, because they've got a lot of cell lines from those already at the San Diego Zoo. So two of the things that are exciting is now with this partnership, when we develop this technology here and apply it, we'll be able to rematriate some of the cell lines that they have that belong in Hawaii. And they're really keen to do that because they have this understanding that these are the embodiment of the Hawaiian people, right? These are their ancestors and they belong here in Hawaii. So it's like a returning these people back to their homeland. And so they'll be kept here.
And so, like, with the discovery of those two snails on Kauai, gosh, it's just, they were here all along and we haven't seen them.
Wow, that's very hard for me to articulate right now. It's more of a feeling of happiness, relief, excitement, all of that combined, but also a little bit of tinge of sadness of what else are we missing? What else are still out there that are just waiting for us to find them again so that we can protect them, so that we can tell everybody that they're still here, that they're part of the forest. And so, yeah, so it's always still it's hard to put into words all of these feelings combined on what we're trying to do here with all of our partners on all of these different islands. But I'm always very grateful how we have been able to build up so many interests in these snails on all of the different islands. And so I'm very appreciative to all of the teachers, the conservation managers, the community, all of our workers that are just just rooting for us all and rooting for the snails to still be there for us to appreciate, to learn about, and to remember.
And then we do have the festival coming up.
We are very excited to expand the bridge with the science, the culture, with the community. And so we do have several new things coming out. So we're hoping to showcase some new species that we have in protective rearing in Pupu'ola that we would love to share and talk about these species from the different islands to the community. We also have Queen Liliuokalani's lei that will be on display for this night, for the public. And we will have cultural advisors from the Bishop Museum to be talking a little bit about the history of the lei and also the significance of some of these snails in Hawaiian culture.
For listeners who may not be aware of the lei, it's not a flower lei, it's a shell lei.
Yes, it is an Akitanaela shell lei. And the story goes that the queen, as she toured the island, was gifted different shells from different areas of the island that represented them. So it's a very important, significant, not just because it's Queen Liliuokalani, but how it embodies the diversity of these snails throughout Oahu.
And while it is a kuli festival, this year's theme is make reviving and reconnecting culture back into conservation, right? Bringing back those indigenous voices, the songs of the snails, right? As Nori mentioned earlier, people say that the snails no longer sing, or this year's theme translates directly into the snails sing, because they still do sing, right? And the rediscoveries of these are proof of that. They're still singing to us, right? You just got to figure out how to listen and where to go to listen to them. And not only are we going to share that, but we're going to have a panel from our snail naming hui. They're going to help us provide scientific and culturally meaningful embedded names for these new species that we're describing. And we're describing one new one right now that's going to be part of that. And that's going to be premiere at the festival. Some of that is a new species from Maui, one of these tree snails. So people get to come and see images of that. And we have it also in captivity so they can see it live. So yeah, some exciting stuff. And then we also have a panel that consists of some council members that are serving on the Green Fee Advisory Council. And we're going to have a panel discussion about the Green Fee and maybe what it means to conservation and how it can be best utilized to leverage that opportunity to do more conservation broadly in Hawaii.
Yeah, got to get a piece of that.
Yeah, exactly. $100 million a year, that'll go a long way to helping conservation. That's what we're hopeful for, is we really think there's a lot that can be done with that, and Hawaii really needs it, given that we have, again, half of all endangered species on the endangered species list are here in Hawaii.
Yeah. Well, that'll be something for the snails to sing about.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely something for us all to sing about, for sure. And then, of course, Honolulu Brewing Company will be there with their annual Kahuli Brewly. So they produce a Kahuli beer each year. This one we're really excited about because it's going to be one of our endemics here on Oahu called Laminella sanguinea. It's this sort of beautiful strawberry cherry red with black ziggy zags in it. And they're making a red IPA in honor of this. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Now, the beer's not made from snails. It's just made in honor of the snails.
Toast the snails.
Yeah, to toast the snails. Exactly.
All right, here's to the snails. That was Ken Hayes and Nori Young. They are malacologists at the Bishop Museum, our snail experts. Just this past weekend, the Big Island played host to a Kahuli Festival. Tomorrow is Maui's turn. And then on the 25th, this weekend, Bishop Museum will kick off its fourth annual Snail Festival. Look for links and pictures of those precious snails on our website later today. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. And on this week's Manu Minute, we learn about the yellow-fronted canary. Recordings are thanks to the Mokale Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Yellow-fronted canaries are native to sub-Saharan Africa and were intentionally introduced in the mid-1960s, both on Oahu near Koko Crater and Hawaii Island near Kona. They've since become incredibly common on both those islands and are found on the other main Hawaiian islands as well. If you live near a town or city and see a small bird that's mostly yellow, with grayish wings and head, but with a bright yellow stripe above its eye, and in particular is spending a lot of time singing, it's most likely a yellow-fronted canary. The well-known common canary is a different species and hasn't become established here, except for on Midway Atoll. Yellow-front canaries mainly feed on grass seeds, flower buds, and small insects. They often forage in mixed-species flocks with other small introduced seed-eating birds, such as the saffron finch. Yellow-fronted canaries are also one of the many non-native bird species that inhabit the lowlands that are resistant to mosquito-transmitted diseases like avian malaria that are preventing our native bird species from living in these areas. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Biology Department.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges. Learn more about supporting these habitats of endangered Hawaiian birds at friendsofoahunwr.org.
When you're in between worlds, where do you belong? This Thursday at 6 p.m., join HPR's Live from the Atherton for a discussion on culture, folklore, and identity with Hawaii Island author Nikki Vandekar. Nikki is the author of the new novel, The Invisible Wild. RSVP for this free event at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, with works from around the globe spanning 5,000 years, offering fresh discoveries and new perspectives. HonoluluMuseum.org.
What happens when a bird sues the government? Well, that's the premise of a new film that tells the true story of the Palila bird and a landmark court case, Palila versus Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources. The film is titled A Paradise Lost, and it makes its world premiere at the Hawaii International Film Festival. Alare Sumie is the director and producer of the film. She joined the conversations with Maddie Bender in our studios to talk about the documentary. They were also joined by Louise King Lanzalotti. She's the host of HPR's Kanikapila Sunday. Lanzalotti has a special connection to this story. Her father, Judge Samuel King, decided the landmark case in favor of protecting the Palila bird. Sumie starts by describing how she set out to make the film. It grew out of a thesis project.
I ended up making a film about Hawaiian birds because I like drawing birds. I like drawing trees. And one day I was like living in New York. I said, I should try to draw a Hawaiian bird in a Hawaiian tree. And I was realizing I have no idea what that means. And then when I started researching it, it was like, oh my gosh, we have some really amazing birds in Hawaii. I had no idea. I never learned about it. I originally wanted to do a film about Alala, but the work that they were doing at the time was about Palila. So there was stuff I could film. And that was, I think I took a semester to make. Finished it. I was like, all right, I made my Palila film. I screened it in Hawaii, and all the people I worked with are like, there's more story. Like, you should keep working on it. And I said, okay. All right, well, let me pitch it to PBS Hawaii. And they were interested, and they said, that sounds like a really interesting film. No one's made a film about Hawaiian birds in the way that you're working on it. When I got a lot of support to continue and to make a story about this, I began that journey, and they said, oh, it'll take maybe 3-5 years, and it has taken 10 years. It has gone through many iterations to land to the film that you guys got to watch.
How did you make the decision to have the Palila tell its own story, have it narrated, and then, you know, decide to script it from such like a voicey perspective?
So I am an animator, and one of my mentors, her name's Kelly Anderson, and she knew that I could animate because I'd done animation while I was in school. And she said, you know, since it's the bird is the plaintiff, like, you could animate this. Like, that would be really a good use of your skills. And I think that would, it makes sense that you would animate the bird because, you know, it's a stuffed bird. So I said, oh, that's an interesting idea. But it took a while to figure out how to make that work because a couple earlier versions, it just didn't work. Because he's not just a narrator, you know, it's like he's not like a voiceover, voice of God narrator style. Like, he actually built a character with his voice, and it took me about 6 years to find him. And he's a professional voice actor and actor in Hawaii. But to find someone who could just do all that only with their voice and understand who the character was, he's like, yeah, I wanted it to be like an uncle, You know, we tried more like pigeon. You know, we did a whole range of like, I wanted him to feel really authentic to when you have an uncle who knows a lot about the island and tells you about it, you know, that kind of vibe. My inspiration was Yoda, the Dalai Lama, and just all the uncles, Hawaiian uncles in Hawaii that are kind of a little bit rascal, but really wise and just kind of irreverent. I wanted that reverence because that felt like a really appealing characteristic.
Talk about the challenges of adapting this court case and, yeah, how this film changed over time as you thought about ways to show this to people.
Yeah, so the film was always centered on the lawsuit, which is Palila v. Hawaii. In 1979, Palila was the first animal to be named as a lead plaintiff in a court case. So before that, no one had ever tried to make an animal a plaintiff. And it was also using the Endangered Species Act, which was new at the time. So this was one of the very first cases using the act to protect an endangered species. And at the time, they hadn't set any rules. They didn't have anything established. So they basically, the attorney, Mike Sherwood, said, let's try this clause of harm to endangered species, which means do not, other than shooting and killing it, it's also harming its habitat and what it needs to breed and to survive. And before that, it was basically don't kill the animal, but anything that impacts its livelihood was the new part of what this lawsuit did. And at the time, you know, they were like, well, we'll see, we don't know. This is such a new law. And I did all the legal research, and originally the film was much more deeply delving into that lawsuit. And I had a scene, I think, an animated sequence about 30 minutes that took the transcript of the case and basically recreated it. But what I found is the audience just did not, they were kind of falling asleep. It just wasn't exciting and interesting enough. And I think maybe the impact of the case might be more compelling, and also how it has changed over time. And so that is the pivot that we made. And we always knew we were going to show what work is being done now, because the person in charge is now a Native Hawaiian. You know, he made such a significant impact in how that conservation was portrayed, even just the way that he talks about it, that it wasn't just science. You know, he really brought a lot of his indigenous knowledge, his cultural history, and his family's history with Mauna Kea, because his family is 14th generation stewards of Mauna Kea. And like, I think when he brought that kind of, this isn't just my job, like that's a very different reason of why you protect something. And Kala just was wonderful to work with, and he just represented a whole different side of protecting something from a Hawaiian perspective that was so natural to him. And really, I couldn't have asked for a better character to cast for that piece, because it really connected to what Judge King did, because he also was trying to represent his Hawaiian heritage and what that means to protect something that's so vulnerable, and what it relates to your own everyday life and your livelihood and your family in a way that isn't just, I get paid to do this, you know? That was really meaningful to hear.
Luis, your dad was the judge on the case in its first iteration. He's mentioned in the film. But what insight do you have on how he ruled in that case? And it was a landmark case. It was the first time that an animal had ever been represented and filed a lawsuit to protect itself and its habitat.
Yeah, you know, it was a perfect storm. The lawyers were so brilliant to do that. It was just a way to interest people in what was really going on. It's just like, oh yeah, endangered species. But no, this was the bird, and the bird was there the entire time. And the fact that he accepted it made it work. You had to have a judge who would accept this case. And he knew immediately that this was going to be a really important case. Landmark, first time it ever happened. I think he wanted to make sure that this was like a model for how you could do this in the future. You kind of talked about that. You know, one of the things that I thought was so brilliant about it, so I'm kind of skipping to the end, was that when they made the first decision, it was to put some fences up. Put a fence, kill the animals or get them hunted, whatever. Then build a lower fence, keep going. And he actually made people report to him every single year until he died in 2010. And then another judge, his buddy, another judge took over the cases for reporting after that. So it is an ongoing issue. So that's why I think the timing of this is really excellent to remind us that we are endangered in so many ways here. Mm. And this is a seed for what's going on.
Were there moments of the film that stuck out to you, Luis, or anything that you have questions or feelings or thoughts about?
Just seeing my dad.
Even do you like the animated version?
I still miss him. He's been gone for a while. But, you know, just I think he was so proud of that case. And my whole family is, I'm wearing my Palila shirt. We have all kinds of evidence about Palila, and we haven't given up on it yet. So I think it is challenging, and it might not make it, but it's so important that we try, that we are inspired to keep going with other species and with Hawaii as a whole. We're endangered, too. Our culture is endangered. We're trying to bring the language back. We're trying to bring culture back. So all of that is really important, and I'm so proud of the people who just keep fighting. They don't give up.
Yeah. What do you think his legacy, your dad's legacy, is with respect to this case and this bird?
I think that America is a very varied country, and you need to have people that are deciding things in the position of judges who can make decisions that relate to maybe the American story, but also that understand the place where they are. You know, Hawaii is based on place. The land is our ancestor. And I know that my dad he believed that, although he was, as I said, an American too. So I think that is one of the things that I think is so important, that we keep making sure that we take care of all these different perspectives. And that's one of the ways that it happened. He did get feedback from some of the other judges too at the time. So I'm just saying, sometimes you have to just take a step and go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was very brave and so progressive in having the foresight of making the decision and really sticking to his guns and really advocating for Palila above and beyond of what he actually had to do. So there was a lot of courage and bravery in just saying, I'm putting my foot down about this and I'm making it very known that this is how I feel. You know, he did not hide that at all. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add? Any memories you want to share?
I know Dad would be very proud of having this story continue. And as you said, it's still being watched over. So thank you so much for doing it.
Yeah, actually, I have a question for you about your dad. Do you mind if I ask? Because I never got to interview him, but I watched as many interviews as I could, and he was hilarious, and he would have been such a great interview. Can you tell me, if I got the chance to interview him for this film, what is the one thing he would want to have said and be in the film? Because I didn't get to interview him, so.
Well, you know, it was his favorite case. He had some huge cases, great import. Criminals, all kinds of things. He sat on the Ninth Circuit a lot. He traveled all over the country. He taught law. The fact that he focused on this as one of his favorite cases, it kind of says it all to me, that he would want to be sure that people knew that it mattered, that this matters, that protecting the innocent, protecting the people who can't protect themselves, that was basically what he was dedicated to, I think. That's not funny, but he would have had a really great, targeted, funny way of saying it, but I think that matters.
That matters. That was filmmaker and animator Laurie Soumier talking with HPR's Maddie Bender and Louise King Lanzalotti. Soumier's film is titled A Paradise Lost. It's playing this afternoon at 1:30 at Consolidated Theaters in Kahala. The film will also air on PBS Hawaii and PBS Network. Well, that wraps it up for us. Tomorrow, we take the conversation on the road. We will turn the spotlight on Chinatown. What are your hopes or fears now that the city has given the green light for a downtown business district that excludes Chinatown? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation. Thank you.